Hi, everyone. Welcome to this bonus episode. This is why I'm starting first. We had two of the co-founders of the Debt Collective, which were
Luke Heron and Thomas Gokey, co-founders of the Debt Collective, major organizers, major players in this student debt game for years. And they were able to shed some light on what the heck is going on, because there are so many headlines right now. It's really difficult to keep things straight. So we touched on the debt ceiling. We talked about the potential for payments to be restarted. We talked about Biden vetoing this bill that was meant to demolish his debt relief plan. What else did we talk about?
And we also talked about strategies. There's new strategies that are coming up next month. So there were little tidbits hinted at the possibility of new things with it happening within the Debt Collective as a movement. So stay tuned for that. And hopefully that gives you a refreshed hope and guided momentum, really, because I know a lot of us have been wondering what next, what do? We might feel stagnant, but there is a lot of movement, believe you me.
We also touched on feelings of anger. I know Thomas mentions that he mentioned the last episode also, and also this episode. So Talia, really quickly, what are you doing as a fellow activist to preserve your sanity and your mental health?
That's a really good question. I am staying active within the Debt Collective circle because I'm a member. So we have our theater troupe, which has been just a saving grace in many ways for me and for many. And also doing, a lot of self-care, you know, being in community, being with people that I love, really cultivating joy, because these times can feel really menacing and heavy and fatalistic. So making sure I cultivate joy. I mean, holding space for my anger as well, but just making sure I do it in a safe container. How about you, Boo?
Oh, I think I've taken the opposite approach. I've checked out a little bit, which has been really helpful. I found a lot of solace in the Debt Collective Slack and also my Instagram at Student Debt Brand. And just taking a couple steps back and actually not checking in for quite a bit now has been really helpful, because it can be a lot. It can be a lot of information.
Yes.
And a lot of processing and a lot of turning to the person next to you and helping them also understand what's going on. And so just taking like a refresher, taking a minute has been good.
Yeah, it's important to do whatever your body, your heart, your soul, your mind calls for you to do when it comes to taking care of yourself and your communities, and remembering that we're not alone.
Yeah. And I think it's really important too, because we have a big fight coming up here. Like, regardless of what happens in June,
we need to rest.
Yeah. This is the time to rest and to get ready for what's coming here later in this month. So.
Yeah. Definitely. Really, get the rest, get the joy you need, turn off whatever it is you need to turn off. And rest up and come renewed and regenerated, because we're going to shake shit up. There you go. I said it properly now. My retainers let me say it properly. Y'all hear the rest of the episode and you'll know why I say that.
Exactly. Enjoy this episode and thanks for listening. Let's get right into it. There's so many things going on. There's so many updates. It is so helpful to be able to get some wisdom and clarification from folks that are close to the information. So Thomas, Luke, welcome to the podcast. We have so many questions for you. A lot of us are just trying to keep up. I even got some texts last night from family members like, hey, what's going on with the student loan debt stuff? What's going on? I haven't heard anything. I think sometimes even the information that we're getting is a little conflicting. So let's start from where I think you, Thomas, and Nikki left off with the last episode. So we talked about this bill that was proposed to end Biden's student debt relief plan. Biden vetoed that recently. Can we talk about the significance of that? What does that mean?
Yeah, so it's not significant in the sense that it's not going to become law. So it's the significance is all in other areas, right? So one thing is it forced everybody to take a vote. And so we can see where they stand. In total, 5 Democrats voted to kill student debt cancellation, and all of the Republicans did. And I think that's a vote that's going to haunt the people who voted to kill cancellation. But it also, I think, sends a signal to the Supreme Court that is maybe not helpful, but I don't know, Luke can weigh in. I've also read a legal analysis that said that since Congress has the ability to pass legislation, and this is really up to Congress to kill cancellation if that's what they want to do, Congress just failed to kill cancellation, and the Supreme Court should leave it at that. So I don't know, Luke would be a better analyst on that than me.
I guess the only thing to say about that is that there's no consistent way that the Supreme Court treats how Congress deals with a pre-existing law. So we can say what we want both ways. The Supreme Court can interpret, oh, well, a lot of people voted in favor of it, or it didn't pass. The Supreme Court still thinks they're the ones who get to say what the law says.
Why do this? Why propose the bill before the Supreme Court has the opportunity to rule on it? Is that just more posturing, do you think? Is that some kind of strategy?
I don't know. Luke, do you have ideas about this?
I can only speculate, but I guess there's a few reasons that Republicans might do it. One would be messaging. Another would be to force the vote. They think they could possibly win. And another is one thing that we see in the Republican Party is that they are very disciplined in being opposed to the Democratic Party and to also all that's good and holy in the world. And the Republicans are, there's like a substantial base of Republicans who are refusing to let anything happen in the House right now because the debt ceiling bill passed and they're just throwing a tantrum basically in Congress. So they're happy to do stuff like this. They don't actually really, I don't think they really care about passing that many laws. A lot of their political project is making loud complaints, getting into office, and then making a lot of money.
Can we just tap into the debt ceiling conversation a little bit? Because I know I am on the outskirts. I'm seeing headlines. I'm going to work. I'm coming home. I'm eating dinner. I'm going to sleep. I'm waking. I'm doing the whole thing again. And I'm a little confused about how the debt ceiling correlates to student loan debt and how are they related. Does anyone feel comfortable answering?
Thomas?
I mean, there's a couple things to say about it. The most direct way that it relates is that part of the deal was to restart student loan payments in September. And it's pretty clear that this was something Biden wanted in the deal. This wasn't like a concession that he made to the Republicans. But it's also something the Republicans wanted in the deal. So it's like that they agree on that.
Bipartisan consensus.
Right. But I think that stepping back a little bit, I think the debt ceiling, there's a lot to say about governing by debt, or that the debt ceiling is just fake. It's made up. It shouldn't exist. And in a very real way, it doesn't exist. There were ways of raising the debt ceiling that wouldn't have required a bad deal like this. Like, for example, the Democrats controlled the Senate and the House and could have done this on their own. But there's also a question as to whether or not the debt ceiling is even constitutional, and they could have forced that issue in a way that would make it more likely that the Supreme Court would say it's not constitutional. They could also mint a coin. There were ways to avoid this, but it also was a way everything that is a part of the deal is really, really unpopular, right? There's nothing anyone wanted in this. So it's a way to push a lot of unpopular stuff through for a fake made-up crisis that it's only real if everybody pretends that it's real. And so they're all really pretending that it's real and then pushing through all this really unpopular stuff that the Republicans wanted to push through but didn't have to vote for, and a majority of the Democrats voted for it, including a lot of people from like the Democratic Progressive Caucus, to the point where it's like, it's clear there isn't really a progressive caucus in any meaningful way. And so it's, I don't know, it's, if you want a good index of how everything is messed up, this is a good thing to pick.
And also, yeah. I can't help but feel, this is my personal analysis, that a lot of these, as you term them, unpopular bills or whatnot, they were just used as bargaining chips. I mean, the whole, from the beginning, this idea of any sort of cancellation was always something that many party members, both Democratic and Republican, especially the whole Republican team, didn't want. And I feel like we were used as pawns for the pockets of certain people. And the only reason why the Republicans are still crying over anything is because they didn't get their pockets filled enough like they wanted to. And it just, I feel like that whole, it's just so blatantly awful. Like, how do we move from that as a movement, as a debt collective that has been working so hard for a decade and a bit more on this? We've done strikes, we've done this. We've gone to the point where we're like in the White House now talking to the president about these issues. And then to be given a blow of this nature, I just feel it's just so hard not to feel like, forget the stab in the back. This is like harikiri. Like, this is just like in your face, I'm slicing you and you can't do anything about it. I mean, it's just awful, I feel. What are your thoughts about that as like a person, Thomas, that has been doing the good work for so long? Like, how do you feel at this moment? Especially when we're talking about, like you said, the debt ceiling is just made up. He could have also used the 14th Amendment and just been like executive action, like, forget this, we're going to do what needs to be done. He didn't have to do this negotiation that he did.
I mean, I feel very, very angry. But I also think there's a lesson here in terms of like, it's almost like this is the mirror image of the project that the debt collective has been trying to build, right? That the extreme Republicans really did use debt as leverage to force through a lot of austerity. And I think the only thing that can match that is people coming together to use debt as leverage to force through the kind of deep structural changes that we want to see.
Just piggybacking that, again, one of the most disturbing things is that a lot of these crises are that they're made up, that the debt ceiling is made up. This argument about how Mohila owes the state of Missouri this $100+ million that they haven't paid for how many years, but all of a sudden now it matters. It's just, these are made up scenarios. And I think that's really frustrating, and it feels like we're watching a slow moving train with these very loosely put together arguments that for some reason are able to garner attention and now have made their way to the Supreme Court. And it feels like our lives are in the balance. It's just really unfortunate. So do we have an idea when in June we'll know? Because I read earlier this year that it might be late June. Does anyone know?
The short answer to that question is we don't know. But I just want to briefly respond to something you were just saying, Shauna, which is, you said for some reason these cases have made them their way up to the Supreme Court. But it's worth noting there is a reason. There's a movement on the other side that has built for years and years through the Federalist Society, through a whole number of different foundations and policy shops that makes it possible, that appointed people on the court that made it possible to basically reshape the law, but also to be able to just change the law in a moment to get to achieve an outcome, to skip a case right through the appellate process and so on. So that's its power, and it sucks for us, but it's also, as Thomas was saying, good to look at as a sort of inverse inspiration.
Yeah, that's true. So stepping back and looking at where we are now, so Biden's vetoed this bill. We're now what? We're in early June. And so now we're still waiting on this decision from the Supreme Court. we're hearing that the Department of Education plans to start payments, what is it, 60 days after some kind of court decision or 60 days after June 30th. And so what happens next? And how do we prepare for this?
Well, what happens next is a hard question. I mean, it depends on who we're talking about. What happens? So if the court upholds cancellation, which I do think is a real possibility that we should not exclude, then, you know, we have to make sure everyone is signing up as soon as possible to get their debts canceled. I mean, there's still an application process and so on. And I think we should celebrate. It's not a full victory, but it's a real significant victory. And it's something to celebrate as we move on. If the court strikes down cancellation, which is the more likely outcome, but again, not the only outcome, you know, there is already a lot of people putting pressure on the Biden administration to be prepared and to implement cancellation through another means, which he can do. There's a number of different legal channels you can use to do that, and to do it ideally without any application immediately, to make the legal action happen before he announces it, so that this time, if it gets challenged, it will be after cancellation has already happened, and it won't make its way up through the court until weeks or months after cancellation has happened, which makes it harder to overturn for a number of reasons. So that there's pressure on Biden to do that. We don't know if he'll do it. We don't know. And there's some people in the administration who are in favor of that, who are serious about that. There's people in the administration who think that's too risky, or who think they don't agree with the legal arguments, or a whole number of different things. I don't know. We don't know what they can do. But so what can we do? Well, I think we can make it very clear to President Biden that it's not just a bunch of misfortune that he can alleviate by canceling this debt. It's his own political future that is in the balance. And hopefully he has advisors who are making that clear to him. But we know that a lot of people voted in the midterms in part because, or in large part because, they thought their debt was being canceled. And we know that a lot of people will feel betrayed, whether the Supreme Court caused it or not, by Biden restarting payments. And we should make that abundantly clear that that's a political reality that we can't protect him from. And in fact, we're happy to push on the wound.
To your point, Luke, regarding Biden's political future, I think in the last episode, Thomas, you kind of laid out when payments would start. I forget the scenario. You made it seem like payments would, in a particular scenario, you made it seem as though payments could potentially start like right before an election, right? There was something like that.
First of all, I don't think we should give up on extending the payment pause. Like, it's gotten harder. Things have shifted against us, but there are still ways to do this, and there's every reason to keep fighting for it. And it would be an absolute disaster, both in terms of the human cost, but also just operationally, nothing is going to work if in the process of trying to make this start. So at one point on a previous threatened end to the payment pause, there was an article that floated, maybe there'll be like a 1 year grace period as this gets back up. I haven't seen anything about that with this current talk about ending the pause, but if they were to do something like that, that would put the actual first payment where the threat is real right before the election.
It's just poor strategy.
As it stands now, so they have this program called Fresh Start. Very confusing to me. I don't understand it enough to really like even talk about it without getting it wrong. But my current understanding is that if they really did start payments in September and you didn't pay, you would officially be considered in default 270 days after September 1st, which that's also like we would see the wave of defaults, the unprecedented historic wave of defaults hit just a few months before the election.
Yeah. So back to your point, Luke, that's the point I'm making. It's just poor strategy. I don't know who is in Biden's ear. The political strategists need to get it together because it's just not a good look. It's just not. However way you spin it, it doesn't look good. And then to something you said, for months, the Biden administration has been asked, what happens if this plan falls flat? Do you have a plan B? And over again, they've said, nope, this is our plan. We don't have a plan B. But in these circles, we talk about all the other ways that Biden can cancel student debt. And so that's a little, I don't know, concerning for borrowers that are watching this happen. And we're like, okay, so what's going to happen? Are we going to bob or going to weave? But they're telling us there's no plan B. That's really concerning. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's worth saying that it's probably not to be taken all that seriously that they don't have a plan B. I mean, I don't think they have a detailed plan yet. I don't know what they're going to do yet. But I think their public position has been, we don't have a plan B because they don't want to undermine their position in front of the court. And they want to say, this is all, we're going to win. This is lawful. We don't have any doubts about it. Is that the right communication strategy? I don't know, but that's so anyway, that's only to be taken so seriously. But having a plan B, I mean, we saw, for instance, with the Dobbs decision overturning Roe v. Wade, that there was a leak of that decision, right? Months before it came out. And when it came out, the Biden administration seemed like it was taken by surprise, right? So we know they do have, I mean, maybe they've learned their lesson from that, but they do have a tendency to sort of procrastinate, denying the reality that this court is opposed to the things that they're in favor of.
Speaking of strategies and just thinking ahead, what are some of the strategies that those of us that have been moving along with the debt collective and doing our various parts, what are some of the new strategies that we're thinking through for our listeners to pick up on? Because a lot can happen as we're talking about. I mean, we're thinking from the position of an administration that's clearly out of touch, doesn't seem to care, has its own agenda. So, I mean, it sucks, but we kind of have to move from a position of like not like expecting the worst. And so I'm wondering how that informs new movements within the debt collective, new strategies. I know striking is always there. I'm one of those people. I've been striking since the strike started. But what else is there for us to think through and incorporate into our lives starting from that moment?
So I think one thing that we've been talking about internally is that right now I think it's fair to say there's a lot of anger, there's a lot of despair and doomerism. And there's also a lot of like, oh, you thought Biden was really going to cancel your debt? Like, you're so silly. I think it's worth going back to like the basics on this, where our theory of change has always been that a politician is never going to do this for us just because it's the right thing to do. And if there's a silver lining here, it's that we know Biden never wanted to do this. We are within 1 inch of the end zone because debtors got organized and picked this old man up and dragged him towards 1 inch before the end zone, right? So no matter what happens at the Supreme Court, debt cancellation is only going to happen if debtors get organized and like pick up the situation and drag it over. I don't watch enough football, like the end zone, the scrimmage line, whatever.
It's all good to me, neither do I.
And so, yeah, I think that it's a frustrating situation to be in, to feel like, and to a certain degree, it's true that our fate is in the hands of six unelected wizards in robes who are really corrupt and hang out with like Nazi paraphernalia collectors. But in a more true and real sense, our fate is in our own hands. And so I think this is a time for a student debt strike, and we're going to start doing some public-facing messages or public-facing meetings. The first one is going to be on June 15th, but there will be more. And then we are cooking up some other like new twists or new strategies to that. And Luke has been working on one of those. I'm not sure if we're quite ready to talk about that or not. You know, if Luke wants to talk about it, he can. But like maybe in a month, there would be a lot more to say about it because it'll be more ready in about a month, I guess.
That brings, believe it or not, just you saying that much, Thomas, it makes me feel better. I mean, this is why I feel like this episode is important. It's just because so many of us, like Shauna was saying, like the only thing we know is the gloom right now. And so looking to a new horizon to figure out, okay, what are the new strategies that at least we could be waiting for? Even if you can't talk about it, Luke, just throw us like a little lentil. What is it that a little seed, a mustard seed or whatever, so we can like run with it and like feed on it until the big reveal?
Well, let's just say we're trying to think through some ways to make it easier to express both your displeasure and your reality with student debt to the people who are in charge of collecting on it, namely the Department of Education and the White House. So, yeah, obviously, you should always feel welcome and empowered to express your displeasure to people who purportedly represent you. But we're trying to find a way to make it easier and effective to do that.
That's awesome. Let's center the Department of Education for a second, and let's just talk about resources. Let's take our doom and gloom and focus it on them for a second. Because to what you were discussing last time, Thomas, they're so ill-prepared for this, and I'm not quite sure why there's not more acknowledgement of that on their part. They've hinted at it. They've talked about not having the funding. They've talked about not having the headcount in terms of employees. And yet they're still rolling forward as if they're able to turn on the payments for 45 million people. They can't do this. And I think your quote, Thomas, that I really appreciated from the last episode was the Department of Education cannot do simple things. And it's true. So I don't know. I'm really concerned about what comes next. And I think you even said like, what, 1 in 5 accounts has something wrong with it right now?
Yeah. The CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, did a detailed deep dive examination of a previous servicer transfer when one account gets transferred from one servicer to another. And they found, and this was a relatively small transfer, it was about 2.5 million accounts. And they found that in the process of transferring those accounts, roughly 1 out of every 5 accounts had a very serious error in it, including like the wrong balance amount, the wrong payment amount, a miscalculation that resulted in a balloon payment. Well, since the payment pause has gone into effect, over half of all student loan accounts have been transferred at least once. My loans have been transferred twice, and they might end up being transferred a third time for other complicated reasons that are unique to my situation. And so I think we have every reason to believe that many, many of these accounts, like the basic info on the account is just wrong. And I don't want to tell someone else's story if they're not prepared to tell it in public, but one of the leading student debt experts, like someone who knows this inside and out, backwards and forwards better than anyone else, their account got transferred and the payment amount got miscalculated to the point where they were expecting a monthly payment that was several thousand dollars more than what it should be. Several thousand dollars more. And this person who has all of the knowledge, all of the expertise, knows how to navigate the system, could not get their servicer to correct it, right? The only way they got it corrected was they have everyone at the Department of Education on speed dial and could just call up the top brass and say, my servicer won't fix this. You've got to fix it. And then it manually got fixed, right? But you could throw a dart into any Taylor Swift audience and hit someone who's got a student loan with an incorrect balance like this. Now, so multiply that by 45 million people, including servicers who are like, when there's a problem, how are you going to fix it, right? Are you going to call your servicer and wait on hold for hours and hours and hours? And then in order to fix it, it's going to be a multi-step process. So maybe you wait on hold for 6 hours and then take the first step towards fixing it. And then they're going to mail you some paperwork that's going to take 7 to 14 days to process and to get through the mail. And then you have to take the next step, which is going to be another delay. I mean, it's going to be a part-time job to babysit the Department of Education. And when people don't know what to do, or they've got lives to live, it's just going to create a crisis, a severe financial crisis for them. And it's also going to be an environment where all of these student loan scam companies really take advantage of it. They're going to be calling you, pretending to be the Department of Education, telling you they can make this all go away, handle all the paperwork for you. All you have to do is pay them. And of course, they're not going to fix the problem. You're just going to be out a few $100s. So yeah, I mean, one thing that I've said in the past is if you take someone like Buzz Aldrin and you give him a rocket ship, he can fly it to the moon, right? He's talented. He's got the expertise. But if you give him a cardboard box, it doesn't matter how much willpower he has. He can't do anything with a cardboard box. The Department of Education is nothing but cardboard boxes. It is held together with bubblegum and chicken wire. And when they try to turn the violence machine back on, everything that can catch fire is going to catch fire. So it's not like it's going to be a mess for a month or two and then they get it all sorted out. It's going to be a mess that is worse every single month as it goes on. So it's like, I don't know why the Biden administration wants to light a fuse that is just going to blow up over and over and over and over. I mean, it's just, they're bad at it.
That's also an opportunity, which is to say, like, even if you believe in student debt, like, if you believe the system can't functionally work, right? And this is in some ways, the best case scenario. They've had all this time to readjust the system, check the wire and the bubble gum to make sure it's connected. But if it's just breaking, I mean, they're going to get sued, right? There's a much bigger group of lawyers willing to sort of take on cases now. I mean, who knows what the courts will do anymore, but it's just further grist for, like, this whole thing is not just a violence machine, but a violence machine that is broken. And so if you want to fix it, you got to turn off the machine. I think we're really going to get to a point. We shouldn't delude ourselves. There's only so long that getting the executive branch, the president and the Department of Education to do the fixing is going to work. Ultimately, this is a program that is created by Congress that can only really be comprehensive. We can only get free college when we go through Congress. So I think it's important to keep fighting this battle. Also, we have to remember that it's always been the case that this is one step toward a larger changing the political reality in which the legislature operates. And so it's grist for that mill, but that's not going to be an easy fight. But, you know, it's a fight that's going to require all our energy.
Yeah, I thanks for bringing all of that up, Luke. I feel like you said everything that I wanted to sort of ask, because I sometimes feel this is more like a existential philosophical comment I'm going to make now. I feel like sometimes we try to hold on to something that is just so damn broken, and then it just needs to sort of fall apart in order to better see what we have so we can strategize in different ways. And I'm wondering I hate to say this, I can't believe it's going to come out of my mouth, but it's like, maybe the point is to just have it all blow up to the point where we can get to, I know that going to court and suing is not necessarily it, but for example, that might be the point that we need in order to start having some standing so we can start to, like, bring forth lawsuits and stuff like that. I just feel like right now, like Thomas, you were saying that we were like at the end goal, but I think we're at the end goal holding on to this completely fragile, broken football that is, forget bubblegum. I think it's like being held by just, like, I have no clue, some sort of like saliva.
Well, fewer people are going to college, right?
Yeah.
Some because whatever, they can, you know, sometimes easier to get a job without a college, the difference between a college degree and non-college degree is smaller, but a lot of it's because of this, you know, and, yeah. and that, I mean, for people who believe in education, I mean, for people who believe in education for reasons that are different than the reason I believe in education, right? Who believe it's like important for whatever, training workers and developing human capital and whatever, I don't know, inspiring patriotism or whatever, you know? So yeah. again, like it's yeah. not just the student loan system that's falling apart.
Absolutely.
I think the thing that frustrates me is, I think over the last couple of years, the Department of Education has been saying, hey, we acknowledge that there hasn't been much oversight here. So here we are shining a spotlight on these issues, and we're going to try to resolve some of these things here and there. And so they're reworking repayment programs, and they're calling servicers to task, and that's great. But in the very same vein, they're the ones that are saying, hey, we have the power to turn on these payments. We have the resources. We can do it, when they don't. And so now that there is a spotlight on student debt, now that it's a national conversation, if it falls apart now, I think, yeah, there is an opportunity. I think it'll be really embarrassing to a lot of people who have said, hey, we're on board to make this better for you guys, because it's not. I don't see how it gets better from here. And I like the point that you made about how more attorneys now will be more likely to take these cases. Because even years ago, when I was struggling with my debt payments and just like knocking on lawyers' doors, a lot of them were like, I don't know, student loans? No, I don't do that, you know? So I think there's a lot of opportunity here as well. That's a positive take.
And now, but going to back to Thomas's point, like if all of this were to happen before the election, I mean, that's going to be really bad. I mean, I feel like a lot of people also, like you said, Thomas, voted for the Democratic Party mainly because, or was it Luke? I'm not sure. Both of you have said this multiple times. We all have that, because we were thinking, well, the students are going to get some sort of help now. And it's a bit, I'm just expecting like a shit show of a circus come 2024 elections. And it's, I feel like this is a key issue as to who's going to be the president in 2024. I really feel like this is that important and that powerful. And somebody's not picking up on it. I also heard that Cornel West is running for president. So,
does he have a position on this one?
I don't know. I don't know if he's said yet. I think it's all very new, it seems. I feel like he just announced that recently, like yesterday or the day before, or sometime this week. So, Thomas, you mentioned that you were angry. First of all, we're all angry. But for someone that's been in the game for a minute, I'm actually curious to know, is there something specifically that's making you angry in this moment, or is it just all of it?
Yeah, obviously, I wish we weren't in this vulnerable situation where cancellation could be killed by the Supreme Court. But yeah, I'm specifically angry that they negotiated away the payment pause in the debt ceiling, because that seemed like an important bit of leverage, both over the court, like one of the calculations that's probably going through their heads is, well, if we kill cancellation, they'll just keep payments paused. And if we want to really restart payments, like maybe this is the thing we have to swallow in order to make that happen. And now that's not the case, or seemingly so. And I'm angry because I like really care and feel like the millions of people's lives who hang in the balance. This is really, really real. And I think the Biden administration is asleep on a volcano of anger, and they don't know it. And it's not just this issue, right? It's like it seemed to me like they were surprised that people felt angry when they approved the Willow Project, which is to open up Alaska to fossil fuel companies to drill, when Biden very explicitly made a promise that he wasn't going to do that. And it's like, they shouldn't have been surprised that people are angry at that. So it just seems like they're living on a different planet, and that it's going to be a very, very rude awakening for them when they have to, like, the laws of physics exist and reality exists, and reality is going to come for them very quickly. But I also don't want to live under fascism, right? So like, it feels like winning this victory or securing this victory, both important to ultimately reaching our goal of college for all and making tuition and student debt just something that doesn't exist other than in history books. But it also seems important to making sure that the genuinely scary fascists don't take over and make all of our lives miserable and dangerous in a million different ways. Yeah.
In terms of what we can do to express how we feel in the now, you'd mentioned writing letters to the White House, reaching out to them, letting them know where we stand. We've talked about reaching out to our local politicians as well. Anything else we can add? Because I know that the Debt Collective is cooking things up, but in the meantime, because there is a lot of anger and it just feels like we're waiting. And so while we wait, we might as well be active and be loud. So is there anything else we can be doing?
Well, June 15th, 8:30 p.m. Eastern, we're having a public-facing meeting on sort of next steps, student debt strike stuff. But there will be additional meetings after that, right? So we're going to be doing this on a semi-regular basis. Yeah, and recruit other people that you know who have student debt who are not currently members of the Debt Collective to join and get involved and show up.
So I have a question. Gosh, I really love that phrase that you said, Thomas, sleep on a volcano of anger. And I'm wondering, I know we always center the Debt Collective because we're members of it. But I'm also wondering what other movements, what other coalitions, if you will, other groups in resistance exist that the Debt Collective either knows of or works with that are also doing good work that we can unify, connect to. I mean, I think this is also very important that different groups across movements, I guess you can say, or activism, join in the struggle. So I'm just wondering, who else is the Debt Collective in conversation with that maybe others can look into and just amplify voices?
Yeah, there's sort of a coalition working specifically to win student debt cancellation. Some groups that work pretty extensively on student debt stuff, like the Student Borrower Protection Center, Student Debt Crisis, but also groups like the NAACP, National Consumer Law Center, AFT. But then I think broader now is a time for solidarity on all kinds of issues. And I do think that back to Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street started in the third year of Obama's term, right? When a lot of people felt genuine hope and voted for Obama, thought that a lot of things were going to change, but also thought that you can vote and go home and not do anything. And it would happen like clockwork. They did whatever they were going to do in the first 2 years, and then everything ground to a halt and things were awful. And then Occupy happened in that environment. And I sort of feel like now is a time for solidarity, and really for a lot of other groups that might not necessarily work specifically on student debt, to really join in, because this is something we can still win, but that also we're sort of shifting into that same sort of if anything good is going to happen in the coming years, it's going to happen from ordinary people getting organized and working together. And so I think there are a lot of groups, large and small, that are doing great work, but that some kind of solidarity is needed in order to just survive.
And maybe we can see another mass movement like Occupy Return. You never know.
I feel like every time the Debt Collective has a protest, it gets bigger and bigger, which is really exciting. So I feel like that's hopeful.
Just want to shake. I can't say it. I have retainers now and I'm like, I just want to shake shit up.
Agreed. Is there anything else that we should be following? Any other news that we should be following?
Well, I guess it's also worth saying that there's other movement in higher education organizing world. There's been expanded movement of faculty and staff and grad student organizing with unprecedented success. And a lot of those folks have started to join up in coalitions, one of which is called Scholars for a New Deal for Higher Education. That would be a movement to create, end student debt, because it would be funding a free college. Right. So that's happening. And also, relatedly, the Supreme Court is going to decide on affirmative action this term. And so there's going to be mobilization from a bunch of different folks around higher education in different ways. So it's maybe also worth thinking about that place of motion and organizing and momentum and anger. And of course, the movement for labor in higher education is related to other labor organizing going in a whole bunch of different places. And so bringing this to those spaces is workers have debt. It's one struggle.
Anything else anyone wants to touch on or cover before we wrap up?
It's like there's a lot happening, but also like this weird twilight zone limbo area.
Yeah.
Where things don't seem to be happening quickly enough.
I just also want to say thank you to all the work that you all do, we all do. I mean, even just having this little bit of information shared make those that are part of the movement feel better, that are not necessarily like front and center doing. I mean, we're all doing the work, but the work that you all do in the Debt Collective, it's really empowering. And yeah, hearing it from you all that there's something in the works, that the horizon is shifting and it'll look better, that does provide a sense of a renewed sense of hope. So thank you.
And outside of the June 15th date, is there anything else to promote?
We'll send them to the Debt Collective page.
Working on the link.
For the calendar. Yeah. We'll link the events. Yeah.
Nice. So where can the good people find you? Thomas, I think we know where we can find you. But Luke, where can the people find you on the interwebs to learn more?
Where can you find me? I have a little website. It's like I'm a scholar website. LukeHeron.net. I have a Twitter account, although who knows how long Twitter will last. It's at LDHeron, H-E-R-R-I-N-E. But you don't have to find me. I can find you.
Thomas, do you want to review for the good people where they can find you?
Yeah, join the Debt Collective, debtcollective.org. And yeah.
Awesome. Well, again, just to echo Talia's words, thank you for all the work that you're doing. It really is comforting to know that there's someone or a body that is pushing for quite literally our rights and our ability to afford the basic necessities for our families. So we appreciate you guys. Thanks for coming on the podcast again. Thanks for offering some clarity to all of these news headlines that we see. Thanks for being here.
Thank you guys for having us. We're only here because y'all are here.
If you like this episode of Matter of Life and Debt, subscribe and share it with a friend. It really helps people discover us. Matter of Life and Debt is hosted by me, Shanna Bennett, and created by Nikki Nolan. It is produced by Emma Klauber, Nikki Nolan, Talia Malay, and Shanna Bennett. It is edited by Talia Malay and Nikki Nolan. Transcripts and social media writing is done by Emma Klauber. Our theme music was created by F.A. Achman. Visit our website, matteroflifeanddebt.com, where you can listen to more episodes, access transcripts, and get additional context for the subjects you just heard about. Absolutely for free. The website again, matteroflifeanddebt.com. Thanks again for listening.